You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, and you're listening to I'm Ready for My Close-Up, our weekly look at cinema and other forms of visual culture. My name's Richard Thomas, and today I'm going to be talking to the filmmaker Mark Saunders, and I'm going to be talking to Mark about a film that he's almost completed, which is a documentary biography of the anarchist, socialist, libertarian, writer, theorist, activist Murray Bookchin. Bookchin passed away in 2006. He was born in 1921 and witnessed quite radical shifts in society and culture, as you can imagine. So, Mark, I mean, first of all, can we talk a little bit about you and you know, explain who you are, what you do, what the basic remit is, and then how you came to find Murray?
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm an independent filmmaker, and I come from... I've been involved in independent and community-based media from way back in the late 70s almost, when video was in its infancy. Literally, it was still black and white in those days.
Did you have a Sony Portapack and a big backpack? A
Sony Rover, indeed.
Oh, I did. Right, okay.
Yeah, I did start to use one of those in the beginning. And... And I suppose my work's just carried on as a kind of continuity, and I've also seen lots of revolutions in technology. But basically, I'm interested in making films about things that aren't being discussed, that are outside the mainstream media's ignoring. I'm interested in getting other voices out and getting people behind the cameras as opposed to just in front of the cameras. So people are involved in a story, encouraging people to pick cameras up and not only to use them to document, but also to use them to bring about change as well. So I've done a lot of stuff around urbanism and working with people in places which are going to be so-called regenerated, but actually gentrified, and getting them to go to meetings with cameras and get on the record what they're being promised and who by, and using that as a tool for change. I have a company called Spectacle, which is in essence it's a vehicle for my kind of independent practice, but obviously sometimes I'm working with groups of people, sometimes just on my own. I started a group in a cooperative in East London called Despite TV back in the 80s, and I started Spectacle as a kind of nom de guerre for anything I did outside of the Despite TV remit, because it was a very clear East London-based open cooperative. So that's the origins of Spectacle. And one of my pet projects is about the story, which some people know of, might be familiar with, the Siege of Sydney Street, which is an event where some Latvian anarchists were...
Peter the Painter?
Painter, indeed. And I was way back in the sort of early mid-80s, I started to research about that story, because it kind of intrigued me. It was set in East London, just around the corner from where I was working at that time, and also just around the corner from where, like, my granddad was born, and most of my family come from East London. That's my kind of family roots, I guess. And so I originally just kind of became a bit intrigued about it, but I became more and more interested as I researched it into the lost history of radical ideas that were coming out of the sort of mid-19th century, particularly in the Tsarist, opponents to the Tsarist regime. And just really interested about the way that there were a lot of, sexual politics. A lot of them were vegetarian. I mean, it all sounds very like a contemporary kind of politics that were going on, which, of course, were lost to us because of the the final dominance of the Bolsheviks in the Soviet after the Tsar had gone. And obviously, growing up in a capitalist culture, you don't hear a lot about radical revolutionary ideas here either. And so it struck me that there was, as I say, a kind of lost legacy of radical ideas and radical thought. Or at least it's been kind of lost under a pile of, Marxism and ideas that became much more dominant.
I mean, an abject demonization from mainstream media, really. It's very hard to find, let's think about libertarian ideas or ideologies like anarchism. It's very hard if you peruse a British newspaper or perhaps another media outlet to find anything that it provides a coherent and intelligent analysis of what that is. I mean, it's become a euphemism for violence and chaos, which is actually the complete antithesis of what most anarchists would say that they were interested in. In fact, you know, it's a violent and incoherent system that demonizes the ideology in that sense, which I find mystifying. I find it mystifying from, say, a broadcasting perspective. So we've broadcast a lot of programs about anarchism, precisely because, one wants to find out more, because it clearly the version of anarchism presented to you by the media is rather lamentable and intellectually bankrupt, isn't it? And we know that now there's been a sort of resurgence in anarchist-like ideas and different forms of consensual politics and widespread adoption of direct action too, you know, in terms of, obviously, we can mention the Arab Spring. I'm not by any means saying that these things are anarchist.
Occupy movement.
And certainly the Occupy movement, yeah. Perhaps less so in this country, but certainly in the United States and perhaps even in Spain with M15 movement and so on. I mean, as a filmmaker, have you ever approached mainstream media?
One thing that your question reminded me is that one of the things I discovered in the BFI's library is that around about 1900s to up until 1910, when there wasn't a lot of film being made, one of the genres of films were basically anti-anarchist films. And they were little short films with titles like The Anarchist and His Dog. And there would be a man in a black cape and a black cat, foreign looking, of course, who has a little round bomb with a sort of fizzing fuse, and he kind of throws it, and his little dog runs and catches it and picks it up and brings it to him and blows him up. So little short stories. But some of them are much more sinister than that. And there was a whole... So given the limited scope and media output, it's remarkable that they're actually producing anti-anarchist films, which would have been shown in the sort of little... the early form of cinema.
I imagine a certain amount of anti-Semitism attached to that as well, possibly. I'm not saying that all anarchists were of a Jewish or Judaic background, but I would imagine there's no coincidence that the fear-mongering that was stirred about anarchists in the East End was not unlike the kind of demonisation and fear-mongering that was whipped up by Blair and co, and still exists, really, within the Muslim community. Right?
Absolutely. Well, there are definitely parallels with the Siege of Sydney Street story. I mean, that was presented as a kind of, they were Jewish anarchists. Actually, the work that Phil Ruff has done in really digging down and trying to find out...
Phil's a historian, right?
He's an anarchist historian, yeah, whose book actually about the who Peter the Painter really was is just being... is going to be published in Latvia this week. If you want details, you can go to the Spectacle blog and find out about it. But so far, he hasn't found a UK publisher for that. But, the press reporting in 1910 about the Siege of Sydney Street totally was about Jews. It was an anti-Jew, whipping up a kind of anti-Semitism. In a part of London where some parts of East London were 80% Jewish immigrants. But there was, and in a way, there were a lot of revolutionaries living in London in exile at that time. But the official kind of position was, well, you know, the British worker's not going to mix with these foreigners, so it's kind of self-contained. You won't spread, and if anything that helps to bring down the Tsar is, you know, your enemy's enemy is your friend, kind of. So in a certain, it was pragmatic tolerance of radicals living in East London at the time. But I mean, yeah, they're not very well known is that in Jubilee Street in East London, there was a so-called anarchist centre where they were, it was mainly about education, culture, collecting, helping to support prisoners in Tsarist Russia. But and there was a guy called Rudolf Rocker who ran that place, who is also a fairly obscure character, but very interesting.
I suppose that's sort of synonymous with anarcho-syndicalism, really, I suppose, Rocker. And no doubt probably an influence on Murray Bookchin, who is really the sort of partially the subject of today's programme. But we'll get on to that. The initial kind of question was, like, have you ever tried to engage with mainstream media and about some of these ideas and so on, or present, perhaps, I mean, when you're trying to fund something, such as you're trying to finish, acquire the full funding for this current documentary project. I mean, what's the reception when you go and say, look, I'm making a film about an anarchist theorist and I'd like some money, please? I mean, how is that?
Yeah, I think I have tried in the past to approach broadcasters in this country. I think there's a number of ways of answering that, which is that I've actually always been interested in a kind of non-hierarchical practice, because media is actually very hierarchical in the way that the profession is organised and the breaking up of different, you know, skills and things. So I'm very interested in like multi-skilled, flat, non-hierarchical organisational structures, ways of engaging lots of people in editorial decision making. So I've tried to, as much as I can, find ways to incorporate those ideas into my practice. And so in that sense, I suppose, you know, getting someone to make a film about someone like Bookchin, very difficult thing to do. But I have had things broadcast which have been made by a kind of anarchist ways of organising media and a certain kind of approach to, if you like, the kind of non-hierarchy of knowledge as well, in terms of who are the experts and what is authoritative information and how dubious a lot of authoritative information actually really is. But yeah, I think getting one of the reasons I'm at the moment crowdfunding via this American platform called Indiegogo is because hopefully it's reaching out to people out there who are interested or sympathetic to these ideas, because I don't think television executives are going to commission such a program. If such a program exists, then it's a little bit different, because it may get picked up and broadcast, and that's a little bit, maybe as an independent, what you have to overcome is if you don't do anything unless you get the funding, nothing will happen. Mm. And you have to try and move these things forward without funding as far as they can go. I think with this film, I mean, I paid for myself to go over to Vermont to sit down with Murray for a week, to go through almost a decade a day on interview with him. Not really, and I've done a lot of work on the material, but we got to a point where what it really needs is to sit down for a couple of months to edit it, and also to assemble archive to bring up the production values, because he obviously lived through a lot of very key historical events, and it would be very nice obviously I need to have some kind of archive budget. But I mean, being an independent, I'll find lots of no low budget strategies to get round how you make a kind of very low budget film. So maybe instead of using kind of on the nose literal archive, you know, he talks about this event, you show that event. I might be playing around with more contemporary events to see how it resonates with what he's saying. Because I think a lot of what Murray is saying in a funny way is maybe more relevant now than it was when I did the interview with him.
I've been a revolutionist through the greater part of the 20th century. I will die a revolutionist. I believe this society is inherently irrational. It must either tear down society or society itself must reconstruct itself into a truly libertarian communist world, enriched by ecology, enriched by feminism, enriched by various subcultures that exist today, but universal in its outlook, where we think in terms of a universal humanitas and not in terms of little small identities, be they nationalist, be they gender-oriented, be they racial, whatever you like. Let me stress that I'm a strong believer in imagination, but imagination that's not informed by reason can be as dangerous as it can be creative, as destructive as it can be creative. Any anarchy that is placed in contradiction to democracy, in my point, involves an abdication of any belief in society as such. To me, anarchism should be the most perfect form of democracy, not a rejection of democracy. That is to say, I felt that people should share the planet initially with each other freely, with due regard to each other's needs, needs which are always historically and culturally defined, needless to say.
So you just heard a clip of Murray Bookchin. So I can't pretend to be an expert on Murray. I was just saying to my guest, Mark Saunders, who's making a documentary about Bookchin, that it's only in the last sort of 8 or 9 months that I started to sort of dig into some of his ideas, quite superficially, I must say. But here's the kind of potted history, and I'm using Wikipedia. So if you were to go to wikipedia.org, just do a search for Murray Bookchin, and Murray is M-U-R-R-A-Y, and Bookchin is B-O-O-K-C-H-I-N. So Murray was born on January the 14th in 1921, and he passed away on July the 30th, 2006. Born in New York City, his parents were Russian Jewish migrants, Nathan and Rose. He grew up in the Bronx. His grandmother was a socialist revolutionary, it says here. And he sort of swiftly became enamored with communism.
Many of these ideas came to me from my grandmother, who, in everyday conversation, or when a news item appeared, would sort of embroider or elaborate on what she had either been thinking or reading. She wanted me, let's put it that way, to be a radical. She wanted me to be a revolutionary. She wanted me to be a rebel, as she had been through so many years of her life.
At the height of Stalin's cult of personality and the five-year plans and so on, Murray, like many people, gravitated towards Trotskyism. Then in the 40s, he did his blue-collar bit and worked at a foundry in New Jersey. And he became an organizer and a shop steward for the United Electrical Workers. When did he break with Trotskyism, Mark? And you've interviewed him quite extensively about this. I mean, you don't have to pin it down to a date. I'm sure there's all sorts of footage and yarns you've had to sit through. I mean, that makes it sound arduous. I don't mean it like that. But do you know much about why he sort of rejected some of the authoritarian left, for want of a better term, and so on?
That's the key to it, is the authoritarian aspect of it. And I think that he inherently had this kind of more libertarian basis for his ideas, which I think is some of that he definitely absorbed through his upbringing and his grandmother and mother. But I know that he... he talked about leaving the young communists because because of the way that it was run and the authoritarianism of it. And I think that he also and I think this is why anarchism is particularly interesting for people. For me, anyway, is because it's there is a critique of power in anarchism. That's what it's, in a way, that's at its root, a critique of power. And I think that's often missing from a lot of previous sort of revolutionary thoughts, in terms of, you know, because obviously Trotsky was extremely authoritarian. So I think that he could just sort of see that that as a system, it allowed people like Stalin to dominate. Exactly why he separated, you know, where he got disillusioned with Trotsky. I'm not actually from the week's worth of interviews I did with him, I can't remember exactly what the tipping points were, but he was obviously looking in a post Second World War environment where he kind of acquired his oratory, public speaking skills, by being a kind of street, you know, standing on a soapbox kind of street talker in his union days. And I think he could just sort of see that there was things going on, particularly the way mass production and the way society in the States was going, where he could just sort of see that he needed a new kind of critique that was more relevant. So he was already writing in the 50s about chemicals in food and kind of predated sort of Schumacher by maybe 10 years in Schumacher's Small is Beautiful, and bringing ideas about ecology and the way that the positive technological developments were being used to the detriment of society. And I think that was very key to him. So, you know, I think it was more like just Trotsky just became like less relevant rather than there was a kind of great break with him.
Yeah, I mean, aside from the relevance of anarchism, I think, when you obviously you look at things like Occupy and so on, but I suppose it's the ecological concerns as well which seem to resonate now. Yeah. So interestingly, he wrote a book, Our Synthetic Environment, in 1962, and then his most famous text, I suppose, is Post-Scarcity Anarchism, which I don't know, that was published in the late 60s. I mean, I think there's a long tradition of anarchist ideas of ecology, nature, and so on, which goes back to kind of Kropotkin. But Murray came up with this concept of social ecology, right, which is capital now, machinery, technology, whatever, is able to create an abundance, yeah, and therefore a freer society is possible. You can make machines that make machines that make machines and so on, so maximum leisure, no work. And he doesn't seem to be interested in that sort of difficult hair-shirt revolutionary period of austerity after, you know, whilst we're waiting for the proletariat to be dictated to and so on. But also, I suppose, the other side to that is he must have been fully aware of just how pernicious technology can sometimes be in environmental contexts. And the other thing, I suppose, that I notice is perhaps he's looking towards ecology and biological systems as sort of metaphors for different forms of social organisation and diversity. It's not unlike someone like Deleuze, Guattari, when they talk about rhizomatic structures and so on. They invoke a horticultural metaphor. I mean, can you elaborate a little bit about that? And
well, I don't think, I don't think there was no kind of key kind of tipping point moment for him. But I think some of his ideas came out of the, you know, what he saw as the kind of the lack in other critiques that were around. And I think maybe the remarkable thing, because as you say, a lot of those ideas are kind of fairly commonplace, but they weren't when he was first raising them as an issue. And I think that he also was very critical of an idea of anarchism where you kind of retreat from mainstream society and isolate yourself in, you know, typically into a kind of rural environment, and you know, which you can see in maybe some of the kind of more radical kibbutz type ideas or the kind of hippie movement moving, you know, going off to, you know, Laurel Canyon or wherever it was, you know, to kind of isolate yourself and kind of almost kind of put your head in the sand about what mainstream society
is. A very unappealing thing to sell people. You know, let's live in bivouacs for the rest of our lives, you know, and not have hot running water. So, I mean, he's not, as you say, you know, he's not an atavist sort of primitivist guy like John Zerzan or someone like that. You know,
he's very urban. He's very, yeah, I mean, he's a New Yorker. He kind of, you know, he imagines a society that's going to be happening on, you know, on Manhattan Island, not that you have to go up into the sort of some mountains. And
yeah, I mean, he's, you know, interested in some form of harmonious relationship between technology and nature, whatever nature is. Obviously, we know nature, the natural, is a construct as well. But it made me think. I was reading David Harvey's latest book, was published by Verso. It's called Rebel Cities, which is about liberty within urban space, you know. And he was talking about how sometimes, you know, despite all you say about the commons, there's a point when you have to take interventionist procedures, such as, you know, it would probably be right and proper to declare some sort of exclusion zone around the Amazon or whatever.
I believe in human activity. I believe that human beings should change the world. I believe they should change the world rationally, from an ecological standpoint and from a social standpoint. I am not one of those who believes we shouldn't intervene into nature, because capitalists are tearing up forests doesn't mean that we shouldn't intervene in nature. Because they're eliminating species doesn't mean that we shouldn't intervene in nature in a rational way that would be even more creative than so-called Mother Nature, who seems to know everything. I don't think Mother Nature knows a damn thing.
So the film is in the can, so to speak. It's just a case of needing to sit down and have enough time and space to hone it into a manageable form, right?
Yeah, I mean, basically what I did was I was working on a film called Why Work, and which was a kind of critique of work, obviously, as the name might suggest. And I was aware of Murray's work, and I heard that he was visiting London. I think it was actually the last time he ever came here. So I contacted him and said, you know, I'd like to do an interview with you. And he goes, oh, I don't really want to do any interviews and blah, blah, blah. And he kind of said, so, but anyway, you know, what was it you wanted to do the interview about? And I said, well, it's for a film called Why Work. He said, okay, when do you want to meet up? Let's do it. So we kind of got on very well right from that starting point. And we just sat in a garden, I think it was a little park, near where he was staying, and he talked about work, and surprisingly he actually gave me an exclusive, and he actually told me that he met Guy Debord and the other Situationists, and they actually wanted him, according to his version, they wanted Murray to start the sort of Situationist group in America, which seems really strange. If that, you know, presumably it's true. He's very scathing in his interview about Guy Debord and the Situationists.
Could you just illuminate a little bit? I mean, what was the critique that Murray's an anarchist. As much as I'm interested in people like Debord and so on, it does strike me as being awfully hierarchical and.
Well, that's mainly what he's, you know, he just sort of said, you know, he talks about Guy Debord as being, you know, kind of, you know, irrational, moody, you know, exclusionary, quite a kind of difficult character. And
you know, the thing I love about Guy Debord is, I think up until the, maybe 63 or something, he was still sending his washing home to his mum every week.
Excellent.
I got that. I got that from Andrew Hussey's biography. Yeah. So
well, I can't. I mean, it's just quite. I mean, that just the idea of them all being in the same room, and
it's quite bizarre. Yeah.
It is quite bizarre because there's a certain style that Murray has. You know, maybe it's sort of like the Hemingway of of kind of revolutionaries, maybe an element of that. And so I can't imagine him sitting around with the sort of, you know, effete and maybe a moody situationist. Anyway, so I thought that was a strange thing. But anyway, so that was my first meeting with him. And then he said, so I proposed to him that what we did is that I would come to Vermont and I'd like to sit down with him and do a proper expansive interview. And we did. I mean, he originally was a bit reluctant on the idea of it being, you know, the personality cult. But I told him I was just interested in the origins of his ideas, how they evolved, how his life experience informed that. And so I went and spent a week with him. Well, the first thing I did, he did some of his last ever, they were the last ever public appearances he did in Montreal. At that time, he had quite a lot of contact with the Quebec separatist movement, because where he was living in Vermont was just across the US-Canadian border. And he sort of thought, well, a separate Quebec might be a really interesting place to put into practice social ecology. Which got him a lot of criticism from anarchists. In fact, one of his his very last public speaking event was picketed by a group of local anarchists who were accusing him of adopting a kind of state, you know, being interested in a state. But then basically we spent a week in Vermont, and he's such a great speaker that you basically ask him a question. And then you just have to change the tape every hour. But he just basically went for it, and we spent a whole week together. So I've got some 20 plus hours of him talking, and I know from his partner and collaborator Janet Beal that he was telling me things that he had never spoken about, according to her, before. So there are some things in that material which are kind of new and unique. I think, I suppose, because I was coming from that that angle, it maybe for him an interesting exercise for him also just to go through some of those thoughts, because maybe he hadn't really thought about it. I mean, he was telling me things like as a young age that his family took in lodgers. Oh, no, that's right. They were lodging, and the landlord was a Russian, you know, origin anarchist, and influenced him. You know, remembered conversations he had with him, and I guess there were things that he was talking about which wouldn't fit into what he would be writing about, for instance, or part of his public speaking. But he was a really remarkable public speaker. I mean, the event where he was being picketed, he picked up a flyer from one of the people on the door, and I had him hooked up with a radio mic. And sort of 10 minutes before he's going to give this hour-long public speaking event, he's looking at this leaflet and he's kind of, you know, dissecting it. And basically just about the whole point about everything he talked about in this public event was framed as a kind of response to this leaflet that he'd only just sort of picked up while he was waiting to go onto the stage. So that kind of was a very interesting insight to how he operates and how he's coming from this public speaking.
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, I'm not so au fait with, you know, Bookchin's texts. I've read more about him than I've read by him.
I think that's quite common. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. But do you think he has a kind of rhetorical, kind of oratory sort of style in print, in prose, or does that come across?
I think it's more to do.
It's got an element of spontaneity.
Yeah, I think so. I think it comes across. Yeah.
I mean, you said earlier that now Murray's ideas seem more pertinent than ever, and obviously, You know, we're looking at austerity. We seem to have really sort of reversed engineered culture, society into a kind of 19th century model. And people are completely disenfranchised with mainstream politics. And perhaps people are looking for other newer, fresher political ideas. And one of the things that strikes me about anarchism is it always sort of seems to be re-energising itself, and it's a bit of a black hole. It absorbs all sorts of things. There are many people that seem to be completely on the right that call themselves anarchists. We know that. We even know, if we think about the big society, that in some ways that's an absorption, an approximation, a sort of grotesque reappropriation of some anarchist ideas, right?
Yeah, yeah. Why is he more relevant? I think strong themes in my work, social justice, human rights and urbanism. And I've done a lot of stuff around, the politics of living in the urban environment, how people live together, ways of organising cities and things like that. And I think... maybe one reason why he's become more relevant is because there's more, there's more interest and kind of acceptance that 90% of the planet lives in cities, really, or it's getting to, and it's going ever in that direction, and that's the site of everyday life that. Where these ideas, if they're ever going to be applied, that's where it's going to happen. And I think he was kind of addressing that very early on.
Mark, we should sort of wrap it up now. I feel like we could talk for a really considerable period of time, but time encroaches. And if you're obviously crowdsourcing for the film via Indiegogo, can you give the relevant URL and so on and explain to people, you know, if they're really interested in this idea and really interested in Bookchin and actually want to see this thing, how they can support the project?
Yeah, the site's called Indiegogo. Our project is called Bookchin on Bookchin. So I'm sure a Google will bring you that. Basically, it's crowdfunding, and the idea is that you can give as little as a dollar, which is a bit like liking something on Facebook with a few pence behind it, because PayPal do take their slice. And then there's various levels that you can donate, and the one that and they have different perks. It's a site that's set up, it's a platform set up, so you have to have these perks. But I guess in essence, if someone, you can put in as little as a dollar, but if you put in $50, you get a copy of the film when it's finished and a few other bits and pieces. And then you can go all the way up. Above $250, you get a named credit. You can even buy yourself a producer's title by donating.
How much a producer's title?
I think it's about $1,000. I think a producer's title is $1,000. I think it is, and an executive producer is. I think the executive producer is $5,000. I think you'll just go Indiegogo/Bookchin. I think that will get you the site.
Okay, yes, it's indiegogo.com/, let's try it, so let's see, Bookchin on Bookchin. Keen listeners may hear me actually type in Bookchin on Bookchin.
While he's doing that, I can say that if you can't find it, you can go to the Spectacle website, which is spectacle.co.uk, and on our homepage, we've got a direct link to the Indiegogo page.
And there's quite a bit of material on the site already. You can see various clips, right? And yeah, there's some stuff on YouTube too, is that correct?
Yeah, what we're doing some little kind of excerpts of some of the things he says on YouTube, but they're all linked through to Indiegogo. Bookchin on Bookchin should get you the material.
Yeah, so... I was just going to say this. So it's indiegogo.com/bookchin, and there's a nice clip. Or it's a sort of trailer, isn't it?
Yeah, there's it's kind of required on Indiegogo, and it's a little trailer with me saying something about why we're making the film. I mean, one of the things is that the way that we will make the film, even if we don't reach our target, obviously, but that just will, as it always does for Independence, as I'm sure people in Resonance Radio themselves know that you end up doing a lot of unpaid work. But we're trying to fundraise so that we can pay not just me, but also I've got a group of people who are offering to volunteer to help be part of the post-production team. And I'd like to pay some of them for their work, obviously, and to pay for some archive. So at the moment, the Indiegogo program has got 10 days to run. So if anyone's thinking of donating, it would be really good if you did it in the next 10 days. But if anyone beyond that, whatever we don't reach for our target, we'll still be trying to find funding sources in other places. So if you don't do it within 10 days, it's never too late to contribute if you'd like to.
Okay, Mark. Well, thanks very much. As I said, as Mark said also, spectacle.co.uk is the site for Spectacle, Mark's film company. There's also a subsidiary bit on Bookchin, I think, within the site. Yes,
yes, that's right. Project on the project section.
And a Facebook page. And there's also a Twitter account too, which is...
That's Spectacle a tough question. Media.
Spectacle Media. Okay. At Spectacle Media, if you're on Twitter. If you want to find out more about Murray Bookchin and his ideas and so on, I think you could probably go into akpress.org. They publish an awful lot of his titles. So anyway, Mark, best of luck with the project. Thanks for coming in today, and speak to you soon. This has been I'm Ready for My Close-Up on Resonance FM.